Thank you very much. You're all looking wonderful, and it's good to see that people survived last night in such early morning good spirits. So we're here to talk about community media and the growth of the same, and I think maybe we'll spend 10 minutes or so apiece to begin, and then we'll open it up to all of you. Does anybody want to go first? And I'll have a watch, so I'll sort of...
Okay, I'll go first.
Thanks.
What I thought I'd do is talk about some of the problems that public access has and see how that resonates with the problems of community radio, but also not to end up in a discouraging way. Talk about ways that we might collaborate. I take as my text an email that came through the Alliance for Community Media, which is the organization of community video, the community television movement, and they have a listserv. And this came through as a kind of list of problems that... that stations face, and I just thought it would be useful for you all to see what we're up against. Some of these are from that list, and some of them I've added my own. But the first one is the erosion of rights of local governments to regulate and receive compensation for use of public rights of way. I mentioned that the other night. This was the rulemaking that came down, among other things, the rulemaking that came down on March 14th by Michael Powell, which basically took the funding from the high-speed internet from the percentage which goes to community media. Then secondly, the second problem which was seen was apathy and PEG's poor image from the public's perspective, because too few PEG channels. Am I over time?
No, I'm sorry, you're not over time yet. We didn't introduce you. This is Dee Dee Halleck. I'm sorry. And I won't do any more introduction than that, but just so you know who's talking out there.
And I'm with Paper Tiger Television and Deep Dish Television. And Free Speech TV. Too few PEG channels live up to their potential for diversity of voices and as a catalyst for change. And some of the program is ego-driven, are just plain boring, too few active volunteer producers. And PEG is a magnet for social malcontents, which often makes the programming controversial. And by defending freedom of speech, we are promoting porno. According to some people, PEG does not do a very good job of marketing their strengths to cable viewers. Three, local governments eliminating public from PEG access franchise agreements. Now, PEG stands for public, educational, and government access. And obviously, the most troublesome part of this triumvirate is public access. So, what we're seeing in a number of cases is that cities will say, well, we really like government access, obviously, and we really like educational access, but public access is a pain in the butt, so why have it? So, and that is happening in a number of stations, in a number of communities. That's like one of the areas that I think there's a problem. But on the other flip side is some governmental agencies have seen PEG as something they can fill. And one of the more ominous aspects of the Alliance for Community Media conference that I was at was there was a booth in the trade show for every branch of the service. So there was an Army booth, an Air Force booth, a Marine booth, a Coast Guard booth, all with their videos, which they will give a PEG station free to run to promote recruiting, etc. So on one hand, you know, they're trying to eliminate PEG, and on the other hand, if they don't eliminate it, they're trying to fill it up with government propaganda. So that's a problem. Four, media consolidation, which is destroying localism and increasing pressure on the bottom line, so that it becomes very, very hard to actually negotiate with these cable corporations because they're just so big and they don't really even have a local, in some cases, a local office. If I call up with a complaint for Roadrunner, which I have through Time Warner AOL on my cable modem, when I talk to the service person after waiting 40 minutes and going through several phone trees, when I finally get to somebody, that person is in Minneapolis that I'm talking to complain about. That's number five is industry convergence, which is resulting in a very broad and very well-funded attempt to close down access any kinds of public regulations. So that is happening. There's huge amounts of lobbying money being spent to actually just defund, to deregulate everything. cable modem service, number six is cable modem service has been defined as not being a cable television service under the local franchise fees, which is how they eliminated the high-speed internet access by saying it's not a cable service. And that same thing could happen and is happening in terms of actual cable. And then difficulties in diversifying sources of sustainable funding for access centers. And this is one of the things that I think actually there is some hope, because a number of access centers have been able to almost generate equal amounts of funding that they get through their cable franchise from like local state educational bureaucracies or foundations or whatever, or even selling tapes, offering services. So, but there needs to be more of that kind of diversification of funding sources. And then bandwidth grabbing by PBS and local governments. I mean, that's definitely happening. And the growth of DBS, which is actually putting a lot of pressure on the bottom line in cable, because direct broadcast satellite is in this area up here, it's cheaper than cable. Actually, you can get the DBS channels, you get pretty much the same channels, but you don't get the local channels. So that is a problem. So what can we do? I think obviously, I'm sure some of these problems resonate with you all. And I think one of the real important things is to work together and see where these problems kind of connect and see what we can do to work on it, really get active on a national level. I think there's very very weak kind of a media reform movement or any kind of media activism in this country. And I really feel we need to rev that up and collaborate together. And the good thing, I think we have allies that we never had before, which is I was very involved with media reform in the 70s, and we didn't have FAIR. We didn't have the kind of statistical research that they've done. I think we have a very solid base for building a media reform through various research and through really community media on all levels, and particularly with the internet and things like indie media, I think is stronger than ever before. And I think we can build a really strong and vital media reform movement. So, and we have to remember the global. And I think that if we really realize that this is not just our own local struggle, but also a global struggle, and get involved with the communication rights and the information society on a global level, I think that's that will strengthen our local and federal movements also.
You still have time, but we'll go on to Errol Maitland.
It's an exciting time, I believe, for the growth in community public access media. I gotta say, I remember the first VCR that I ever touched. Was a 3/4-inch deck. You had to take the tape, didn't come in a cassette cartridge. You had to take the tape and you had to rewind it, and the deck must have weighed 60 pounds. And never mind the weight of the camera and the microphones and the other things. And I knew people who were slinging those things around, going uptown to Paragon and producing public access programs. It has changed since then. Now you can produce broadcast quality video in a handheld device. The same thing for radio. Going from a 1/4-inch deck, reel to reel, half hour to tape. Maybe you had to flip the tape because you'd lay one track down and you had to flip it to the other side to record the others, and then you try to edit it, or didn't have the equipment or the production facilities. And we went to cassette decks, and now we are using computers and mini disc. And you would imagine that there should be a growth in the number of people who are recording and producing content. And in fact, more people are producing. There is, however, still a problem with distribution, with getting material out there. The ownership or the control of the facilities where you edit and do post-productions is still limited. There's still restrictions. Some of the places that you do them, like M&M, which we didn't have when we started out, are more accessible. I remember we used to go up to Paragon, and this is in New York City, and one studio and the amount of time and facility you could build, you could book, was small, and I think we had one channel, Channel 16. I came out of a university setting, and one of the unfortunate things there that we had, I guess, a set of young people who, again, with limited equipment and limited access to resources and equipment, were producing on a regular basis. Today, with more access to equipment, at the studio that I used to produce and build, that we have less student involvement, less people telling, I guess, to some degree, their own story in that fashion. But on the other hand, when you look at the computer and what people are doing in their own homes, is that they are talking more amongst themselves in chat rooms and getting music and sound and mixing and splitting and dividing and sending it out to others. So it is a mixed bag. My concern is in the mass communication area and how you get people to be involved in it and to take greater ownership of the equipment and the quality and the material they produce on a local level. The cable company, the providers, are still functioning as an obstacle. I went out recently to a community in Hempstead, Long Island, where folks fought to get access to a channel, but the restrictions on it is enormous. There are content restrictions that have been put in place in places like Queens, where people, if they get political in the programming that they do, that the content is blocked. We hear the problems with porn on the television, where I think now if your material is not language correct, that some access channels will not run it. And you also have the problem of sponsorship or being from the neighborhood in which you're producing from, and the fact that you need to show that you are situated in the geographic bounds. In a place like New York City, you can't easily produce across boroughs or get your information out. So there's also a problem with distribution. I'm heartened to say, however, that the growth that we have seen, or I think we'll continue to see and should encourage in the media, does have a listenership, and it does reach us into places that we wouldn't believe, and that people are in fact listening and viewing what we do. I think we need to continue to encourage that. I think we need to continue to encourage people that when they come in and say to you, why don't you do something, that you enlarge in the field by enlisting them as producers, as content providers, as source, and on it goes. There's some dangers in that, however, like in the case of Farouk Abdelmouti, who came to BAI to help us do a single show, and we enlist him as a producer because of the contacts that he had, and in working with him, and now Mr. Farouk Abdelmouti is in a detention center in New Jersey. Last I heard, he's been there since April. Because we put him on the radio and we got him involved in supplying us with contacts and producing radio programs. And they, I guess, pissed the INS and the Justice Department and whoever that is involved in running Homeland Security off. So I guess that's a problem. Or in my case, where you run into the New York City Police Department. So saying all of that, I don't think you should be discouraged from going out and getting involved, picking up a microphone or picking up the telephone and pitching ideas to stations, going in and becoming a part of it. I think from an individual producer, then you can probably, or an assistant to someone, branch out into the area of beginning to, with, especially with the internet and low power FM, begin to think about controlling or owning the means of distribution, at least some part of it. The growth of the IMC show that it can be done on the internet. The creation of a institution, or we hope to be an institution, such as WBIX, and try to find a niche service, is something that we can do. And when I talk about this niche service, the word that is kicked around a lot of time is broadcast. We talk about broadcasting, but I want to talk to you about the concept of not broadcasting, so-called, but narrowcasting. And in fact, there is a place for narrowcasting. Broadcasting happened when there were three networks in this country, and they all were vying for that market share with the same product. Today you find that even though the ownership of the media is shrinking, the content, I'm not talking about the quality, but the contents of program, the number of channels, and the variety that you have is greater. And they are going to a smaller segment of an audience, that is probably being serviced by the same corporation. Time, I don't know, AOL, Time Warner, these days they probably give you MTV, VH1, some oldies channel if you're into music. And on they go down the line. So we need to find an audience, and we need to pitch our product or our ideas to that audience. And I don't think we should necessarily concentrate on the number of people that will be listening. If we make a good product, if we put it out there and we put some thought into it and we tell a story, I believe that people will listen. And we need to encourage and develop more people like Dee Dee. I remember early on, whenever I went by Paper Tiger TV, that she would give me a video or two and say, here is something, you can show it. Okay, if you're doing something and you want to get it distributed, bring it over. We need to continue to encourage other people to come in to produce, and we also need to share with them the knowledge that we have.
Thank you, Rupert. Introduce yourself, please, for that.
Sure. My name is Rupert. People call me Rupert. It's in the book, it says David Russo. That's some, you know, mother-given name.
You got a nice mother, I want to tell
you. Yeah, she's great. And I work with the Independent Media Center in Washington, D.C., and I'm not really an expert on all there is to know about the IMCs around the world. Before I came here, I tried to prepare a little bit more, and a lot of information is on my laptop, which is unfortunately being used up in the other hall. I thought there'd be a projector, and I didn't know about the big top here. But just the expansion of indie media centers is incredible and indicates to me that there is a huge growth of community media with the internet as the outlet, as the distribution method, which I think is problematic. And I'll make up that point a little later. But just recently, over the tech list of mailing list of the indie media center, there's approval processes for new indie media sites. And Istanbul is a recent addition, I believe, and there's several other ones in the United States and other towns. And that, you know, says, okay, you have a little collective of at least, I don't know, five people. There's some criteria that the tech group has said, okay, you know, it takes some work to give you a website and everything and make it all work. So you have to have a certain level of, you know, grounding and footing to say, okay, yeah, you can have an IMC. But it doesn't take much, really. So they're ever more growing, and the more hard drives that get added, the more IMCs can be made. However, a lot of the multimedia components, the audio and the video, have been relying on the donated bandwidth of one company. And that company, or the person that we've had relationships with there, I heard was, you know, potentially not going to be working there anymore. So you have, once again, you know, donations and a lot of giving to support something, but it's hinged upon a very insecure sort of situation of certain people, certain individuals making the show work. And so I see that as a potential problem coming up for IMCs, how we're going to technically continue to give people the voice through the bandwidth or the internet space. But that's just a small technical thing. Really, if you look at the landscape of all the websites and you see what archives of rallies and experiences and events there are there, it's unbelievable. Finding the, you know, cable access and the larger broadcast space to do that is something that sounds like it's a little more problematic, that Dee Dee was saying, that we don't have the control over the larger distribution methods of television that we should. But I don't see anything really hindering IMCs from growing and keeping going. It's really just people coming together. If they have an office, they have an office. If they don't, they don't. There's still the website, and people can gather anywhere they want to share the media, the tools, the skill sharing, and get their information out there. And we've heard a few stories during this conference of how grassroots stories have pushed mainstream media to cover them. And that's really encouraging. But I don't have really much else to say about, you know, the growth of the IMC thing. I think the people in the audience can enrich in the discussion a lot more. So
I just want to correct one thing, which is that it's not the tech people who made the criteria for starting a new IMC. That has been an incredibly painful democratic process, consensus, whatever. And it started at a meeting of Project Censored in San Francisco, where representatives from 80 different IMCs, including 18 from different countries, came together to try to draw out a process for defining what is an IMC. And then it had to go back to the ones who had already been assigned for approval, which has taken like about, I don't know, 18 months or something. So it's a very complicated process. But the reason that people wanted to do it that way was it had been the techs who were making that decision, and they didn't want that responsibility. They felt that that was inappropriate, and they wanted a more consensual thing from a larger group
and they,
of people.
They actually had to demand. They had to, like, push it through and get it on the agenda. We don't want this power anymore. You know, we're the ones who actually end up doing the work. But, you know, so it forced the meeting out there to put it on the agenda and go through the painful process. It's actually very loving, but of consensing and finding, okay, how do we make this fair? Thanks for correcting that. I didn't realize I kind of missed the point.
Thank you. Everybody's been so good with their time, I get 20 minutes. But I used to live in this area, and I've forgotten how allergic I am to it. So at this time of year, so I may not be able to make it 20 minutes. And actually, I've given Dee Dee my watch to be my watchdog.
Some cut it down.
I want to talk about the international scene, primarily community radio, but not entirely. And I'm trying to think of ways of giving you a sense of the range and magnitude of what's happening, not just globally, but particularly in the Third World or the South. Because if we're poorly resourced, then you know, divide your resources by 10 or 100, and you'll find out what being poorly resourced might really be about. It's not to say there aren't some wealthy areas as well. But when I was in Porto Alegre for the World Social Forum, I had the privilege of being a delegate to talk about the FTAA and its impact on communications in the hemisphere. And in the course of that, met two young people who lived in one of the favelas, one of the slum neighborhoods in Sao Paulo, who had been scavenging junkyards and garbage dumps and whatnot, and finding little computer and radio parts. And from those had constructed dozens of tiny transmitters that were broadcasting at the not 1 watt level, but the 0.001 level. And they had networked them together so that they could broadcast to their neighborhood. No resources, no nothing. Entirely scavenged and had built the station. So that's kind of, you know, one extreme of what's going on. And I think another in terms of the use of media, particularly a lot of us are seeing who are paying attention to what's going on in the Middle East, for example. And you can look at a site like the Electronic Intifada. If you don't know it, it's just Electronic Intifada. That's I-N-T-I-F-A-D-A dot net, I believe. You can go to Google anyway. And despite the destruction of the media infrastructure in the occupied territories, it used to be called the Palestinian Authority, never called the Palestinian State. But despite the destruction of infrastructure there, people were still using cell phones, internet connections, etc., sending out daily postings that were put on the Electronic Intifada. Not reporters. I mean, it was community media. It is community media at its broadest and best, I think. So it's not just this non-technology or mature technologies or new technologies that are being used. I think they all are. And there are innumerable examples of people using media that way that I could speak to, but I want to instead do two other things really briefly. And one is to talk about some of the things that Dee Dee has been referencing and other people have referenced as well, which is the upcoming World Summit on the Information Society. I kind of hate the name, the thought of our being an information society, but never mind, we'll work with their titles. But a lot of people are gearing up for that. And some of the most effective organizing, I think, to date is being done in Africa among AMARC's members. AMARC is the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters. And they have just, out of their own meetings, produced the African Charter on Broadcasting, which is actually a second charter that they've produced. 10 years ago, they produced the Windhoek Declaration, which promoted independent and pluralistic African press. Well, the African Charter on Broadcasting is a revisiting of that in the light of broadcasting and other kinds of information technologies to make sure that they also have access to that. And as Dee Dee mentioned in her keynote the other night, there, although this the WSIS is supposed to include non-governmental participation, there has been already major attempts to marginalize people from those sectors. Thank you very much. And that has been done in a variety of ways. One of the ways that it was happening in Africa is by allowing people in, but allowing the same old voices in. And so one of the things that has happened, this is one of the things that I just love, is there a group of broadcasters, AMARC, Africa, MISA, which is the Media Institute of Southern Africa, Article 19, and some other organizations had banded together for meetings in Namibia, UNESCO meetings in Namibia. And they formed the BLA, the Broadcasting Liberation Army, which they affectionately call the blah, 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 which is sort of apropos of media, right? And the Broadcasting Liberation Army has managed to push through the African Charter on Broadcasting. You can go to the MISA site to see that. But it, like the declaration I have here, which we developed in Milan, which is Communication and Human Rights, the Milan Declaration, it are premised on Article 19 of the Human Rights Charter, which guarantees the right to access to media regardless of borders. And access to media means not only getting information, but putting your own stuff out. And, oh my goodness, we have an interesting critter on the table here. I got my guy out of here. Sorry. So you can see, you can go there and see the way there are fights going on, struggles going on, I should say maybe, struggles going on to dig out space, not just to hang on to it or to wrest it away from somebody, but to dig out space for media in the rest of the world that's not controlled by ours. So they're doing amazing work that will not just affect them, but will affect us, because they're going to the International Telecommunications Union, they're going to the WSIS, and things like what's going to happen with digital spectrum, with satellite-delivered systems, et cetera, is all going to be on the table there, and whether or not we get to have voices therein is dependent on our organizing to do it. And again, you know, you can talk to Frieda Worden about this. She's been, so far has been to a couple of the CRIS meetings. I participated in Porto Alegre and in in Quebec City last year. And of course to Dee Dee, who is part of the CRIS working groups now. The last thing, do I still have a couple minutes?
Yeah, two more minutes.
2 more minutes, I'll use them. The last thing I want to just mention is that when I was in Porto Alegre, I was asked to speak on, as I said, the impact of the FTAA on media, and I couldn't figure out how to do that quite. I was the only American on the panel. Everybody else was pretty much from Latin America and Africa and Europe. I think there were a couple Europeans. And it was a seminar, and I expected to be addressing 20 or 25 people, and it ended up we were addressing 1,000 people at a time, which was the nature of this whole, the World Social Forum. But, you know, I began by trying to tell them that we were media rich and knowledge and information poor. And it was a very weird time to be out of the country in the post 9/11 era, and I was really quite a bit nervous about, you know, even speaking at these meetings. And there's just a whole lot of rustling going on in the room and, you know, through most of the speakers that I'd been sitting through. And as I started to speak and talk about things that I knew most Americans didn't know, like the fact that Iraq was bombed routinely ever since 1992, the room got really, really quiet. And I didn't know what it was quiet for until really at the end when people started to ask me questions. And one of the things that was happening there was that there was a presumption that if you just had access to as much as we had, then you must have power, you must have knowledge, you must have information. And, you know, I think, you know, to say it doesn't necessarily go that way was really sort of... I can't find a word for it, but sort of
startling.
Yeah, certainly startling for people. And then, you know, the discussions began, and I came back and found out that the same thing is happening in Brazil that's happening here, which is the best resource country in Latin America. I brought back a poster that showed the consolidation of ownership and media in Brazil, which just looks just like what's happening here. So all I want to say by closing is that... there is much to be gained by us being engaged at that level because they are anticipating things that we're not anticipating, and we have experience at the same time and have come up against things that have not yet, people in some other regions have yet to grapple with. So there's room for a really fruitful relationship there. But the growth is astounding. In Africa in 1995, there were maybe two or three community radio organizations or stations. There are now over 300 stations in Africa in less than 8 years. Thank you.
May I ask you a question?
Sure.
In a place like Africa, how does radio function in remote villages where people may not have access to electricity, or, you know, the people may be hundreds of miles apart?
In a variety of ways. Excuse me. They have, there are solar powered transmitters. There are generator powered transmitters as well. And another thing that's done in a variety of contexts is that at the points where kind of the infrastructure ends, in Zimbabwe, for example, when you get into the countryside where there's no electrification, there are broadcast points sort of at the terminus, and then it goes out to people, and people literally bring in tapes if they want to participate. So that's not an ideal situation, but that's... a kind of stopgap. But there are lots of little tiny transmitters. There was a film actually that demonstrated one of those once. It was, you know, just like in a little store. The Amark video, if you've seen it, shows people in, I think they were in Haiti, running around with broadcasting equipment on a wagon that they were, you know, they were mobile and moving from place to place. So the infrastructure, the absence of infrastructure is definitely a problem. It's less a problem with radio than it is with anything else. So the other thing that's happening that we're trying to do in Africa is to wed delivery systems that are web-based with those that are broadcast-based. So you know, it's point-to-point in some places, and then it's broadcast in other places.
Can I ask you a question? Were you finished? There's a satellite.
I'm finished. Yeah. Sorry.
I went to this global marketplace at the World Bank, living in Washington D.C. or marketplace. Well, I don't know what it's called. Mm-hmm. They give out a bunch of money to these, you know, starving nonprofits, and they all show up in the big foyer of the World Bank and have their booths and try to get money. And there was, you know, you've got GIS and all these big, you know, crazy projects down to, you know, simple water sanitation projects by a former Peace Corps volunteer. But there was one that's a satellite radio company, and they had a map of Africa, and they're basically big rings, big circles of coverage that they can have. And you have to have this, it requires this satellite receiver, and it also has a computer link in it as well. Yeah. Like, it's an expensive little piece of gizmo, but theoretically you can be anywhere and receive the programming. And they were really looking for programming, and I didn't know, I haven't followed up on what they're at with. Have you heard of them? Or
it's World
Link? No, World Space.
World Space, thank you. Yeah, it's World Space. And World Space has approached a lot of African organizations to provide them with links. They have begun to take programming, including community-based programming, but it is corporate. It's not a public satellite, and so people are really wary of, you know, first of all, they're providing programming free. They're in exchange for this, so they're not necessarily building their infrastructure in those terms. And there's a lot of wariness that, you know, at some point the plug will get pulled or the charges will start rolling in. So there's some concern about it, but it is being used.
I understand that MESA, I met Tracy Naughton from MESA, mm-hmm. and she's very, that's the Organization of Southern African States, and they are very interested in, she was asking me about Deep Dish, because they're very interested in setting up a satellite-delivered thing that would share community mm-hmm. media from a variety of sources around Southern Africa. I think there's great potential for that kind of sharing, which is why I think we should hit up the ITU to give us transponder space and satellite taxes for that. But another potential, if the U.S. isn't able to either kill Lula or bribe the Brazilian population to vote for someone else. If Lula, the Workers' Party candidate, is elected in Brazil, there would be a tremendous potential, because the Brazilian state has several satellites, mm-hmm. and they could set up a satellite transponders that could actually provide programming, alternative programming throughout Latin America. Could be very, very exciting. So who knows what's going to happen with Brazil. Stay tuned.
Can I suggest we go to the audience? And I know, and
come up to the microphone, please.
Yeah, come to the microphone. And I don't think we need to just take questions here. I think we want to have a discussion. And if you have things to say, please come on up and say them. Come on up, Ray. And identify yourself, if you would.
I'm first to go here. Okay.
I don't know if I identified myself at the beginning of my of all this. I'm
Elizabeth Robinson, AMAR.
Thank you very much.
Santa Barbara Station Manager.
I'm forgetting your call.
And KCSB. Public access producer, longtime supporter of Deep Dish
TV. You can leave it on
TV.
There if you want.
I know I'm making a terrible noise. No, I wanted to actually turn around. My name is Mariah Gillarden. I'm an independent producer of TUC Radio, which I started when I was banned at Pacifica and lost my voice on the air and wanted to do a programming on globalization. What I also did, and I want to make a plug for Micropower Radio here as community access, what I also got involved in was broadcasting with the early From the Mountains broadcasts in the Bay Area with Stephen Denifer, and picking up one of the transmitters and taking it around when I did an ecology tour through the Western states to visit gold mines and uranium mines and toxic dumps, which all strangely enough are on or near Indian land. And what we did was we were both collecting information as well as demonstrating this very simple technology, because you can have a radio station for $2,000 and you can run these radio stations totally independently from the grid even. The station we finally decided to promote is one that's built by Veronica in England, and it will easily run from a solar panel or a car battery or from the grid. So you're really versatile with it. And that's that particular station, we helped set up five stations in East Timor with these transmitters because we felt they needed something that they could take away and hide easily, or that would remain mobile, because these stations are not only really wonderful as community focus, they can also be taken on the road. They can help in long marches, peasant marches from one destination to another, where you want to broadcast along the road, along your path. Or they can substitute as a public address system on huge rallies like they have in India, where several million people may congregate and there's no way to actually reach everybody with a public address system. There may not even be the power. But almost everybody has a little FM radio, and the way that works then is that that the speakers are focused around the transmitter, and people everywhere can pick up the signal on their radio. And for several years we have been going to the conference that's being held on environmental issues on native lands, and have broadcast the conference to the surrounding community. And then when we go down into the towns to pick up water or something, people are gathered around the local gas station listening to this station and say, all they're talking about is Indian stuff. What's that? So for the first time, the surrounding community may become aware of... That's the IAN conference, by the way. So this is something really to promote. Also, I didn't go to Haiti, but some of my friends and Stephen Dunifer collaborators went to Haiti to set up new stations and teach people how to build stations and to repair existing stations. We're really moved how many radio stations already exist. And strangely enough, how this church is often involved in running these stations, and how they serve a very vital function, not only in information but safety, announcing raids of militia groups, and helping people protect themselves. And church towers are wonderful transmitter points if they're usually pretty high. And anecdotally, these friends of mine walked into churches where there were two wonderful, huge murals at the entrance of the church, Jesus Christ on one side and a radio transmitter on the other. So what we felt we were trying to do in the micropower radio movement to say that even more than sometimes a plaything for kids and white kids in urban areas here, this is the instrument for the indigenous peoples to advance their organizing and to have fun and to talk to each other. And it's really easy to do. So that's my community.
Thank you.
Radio advancement contribution.
Thank you. Yeah.
Matt Murphy from WERU in Maine. My contribution is going to be a question. So on essentially a question on getting started with a community media center. Our part of Maine, there's a group mostly around the peace and justice community trying to get thinking about getting a community media center started that would be a complement, a local complement, and having the means of production, local complement to the Maine Indie Media Center, which most of the production equipment is down in the southern part of the state. So to have some sort of complement to that, looking for some advice on getting started. In one way, particularly around mission, there are some folks involved who are from, say, the Labor Council, who have some projects in mind, and they want access to equipment to produce it and expertise to help produce it and then distribute it. And then there's others that want to get this equipment set up so the people from the community, they don't know exactly what's going to come out, but essentially putting the microphone, putting the means of production in people's hands. And they can be complementary, but it's not quite this. There's some... everyone's not on the same page as to what the mission of this community media center would be. It's still in the very early stages. So what are some ideas for trying to clarify that when you're getting started, getting people some sort of shared vision, and then some other overall priorities when getting a community media center started? And this is mostly around video production, but it not exclusive to that. Thank you.
It's interesting that the community media centers, which were set up through public access, through having franchise money. I don't know if there's a town that you're thinking of, and do they have a public access station?
Yes.
But this would be something in addition to the public access, or
it's seldom used because there's a private contractor who got
back.
It is, but part of the issue is that the resources to produce the programs, there's a private contractor, and they have some time available for folks to go in and do production, but it's not adequate, and it's sort of a mystery to some folks. It's not like a centralized place, and everyone, it doesn't work like a community radio station.
Right. The thing is, when your franchise is up, usually the local municipality has to make an agreement with the cable company. And when the franchise is up, is usually there for periods of from 5, 7, 10 years. So when the franchise is up, that's a point at which people can organize to actually get those resources. The good thing about public access is there is a ongoing sustaining funding that can come from basically a percentage of the cable fees, and it's only right that these companies that have a monopoly on people's source of information have to pay back to the community. So that's, you know, you should find out when that is, and that would be a good thing to organize around. In terms of setting up equipment, etc., I would think in northern Maine that actually space would probably be easy to get, but maybe heat might be a big problem. But one of the things that's just totally impressed me about the whole indie media is just how quickly these things can be put together. And you know, people, if they feel they have a stake in it, are willing to loan their own personal equipment, and there's a kind of exchange that goes on. So I would encourage you to, you know, have people meet. And the more they get involved in the actual setting up and administration, the more likely they are to... feel good about the way it's, you know, be willing to kind of share space and time. One of the things that's happening at public access stations right now is a whole discussion about whether or not you actually adhere to what's called the first come, first serve principle, which public access was set up on, which means that anybody can come and the first people there can get access to a slot or equipment. One of the things that's happening is when franchises come up, people can ask for more channels, so that not only do you have a first come first serve channel, but for example, is anybody here from Tucson? Tucson has like 9 public access channels, I think. Quite a few. So they're able to have enough space for having some be primarily first come first serve and others be sort of curated, so that there's a culture channel, I believe, and one that runs Democracy Now!
and a lot of stuff from Free Speech TV. So there's a kind of abundance there that, you know, can be very good. But I think in general, people are feeling that public access needs to actually up the level of programming and also up the level of participation and diversity in the stations. So there's a lot of reaching out right now. But and one of the problems happens is when there, and I think this happens at community radio, is a the certain groups of old curmudgeons get in there and it's really hard to displace them, you know. But, you know, the good thing is that you can have, with the, in the franchising process, you can try to get extra channels, you know, and that, I just wanted to mention also that, one of the interesting things, and I went to visit a number of public access centers in Massachusetts, and I would highly recommend the Somerville station if you want to see a very super terrific public access station. It's just really very well run and a kind of model. But a lot of these centers are, a lot of the teenagers have kind of glommed on to these places to run web radio. So there'll be this little corner, and they're doing their, like, 24-hour radio station off in the corner. So that's happening, I know, in a place on the Cape. And I think also Lowell is running a web radio. So a number of places are doing web radio, which is a way to get a lot of teenagers involved. They just really love doing having their own radio station. And depending on how big your server is, you could have a, you know, it doesn't have to, you can have a variety of stations there, too. You could have a number of channels. Doing that.
Can I just say, we just renegotiated, we didn't, it would have been different if we did it. The franchise agreement in Santa Barbara was just renegotiated. And one of the things that's happening there with cable is that it's being digitized. And right now, it's you have your choice of analog or digital, but they're going to force everybody to digital very shortly. And when they go to digital, there are 300 and some odd channels right now. And, you know, like there are 7 home box channels. So there are lots of channels to be had in the digitized environment. And I think it's really important to think about, you know, carving out space for those extra channels that Dee Dee references.
That's an understatement, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I'm sure it goes
I mean,
up to...
I mean, it's an imperative that we carve out the digital spot for ourselves.
Actually, Vermont has a state law. You can get it by going to the Vermont state, and I think it's the Attorney General's office. They have a law that 10% of the bandwidth has to go for public use, and 10% of, I guess, 5% of the funding. But, you know, that's still kind of in contention with this March 14th rulemaking. But that means that, if they get 300 channels, that means they have to have 30 public access channels. That's what that means. Mm-hmm. So
let's get it.
Yeah. So the introduction first, eh?
Yeah.
My name is Gretchen, and I happen to be living in Seattle when the World Trade Organization decided it wanted to hold its annual meeting there. And I was just coming into radio and was invited to a radio meeting. So I went, and Jeff Perlstein was there, who was doing a lot of running around for general indie media coordination. This was like 4 weeks before the WTO was to arrive. We didn't have the website, and we didn't have a space yet. So at this radio meeting, there was Jeff Perlstein and the one person who offered up her house to have the meeting at, who didn't want to participate in the radio project. So it became a task to immediately send out a call. And some of those folks are here, and I just want to thank you for coming and making a wonderful radio event there. But I wanted to ask folks, how many, you had mentioned that you're starting a new community project. How many other people are starting community media-based projects and want to hear about problems that you run into? Just you? Okay, I'll speak to you directly then. Maybe we can talk later. No, I'm just kidding. So it's been really interesting working with the independent media centers. I call myself an IMC audio refugee because I haven't lived in any community long enough to really work within that independent media center, and rather I go to convergences. And at those convergences, I work with another group called microradio.net in the emergency broadcasters block. We try to set up webcasting radio stations specifically for pirate radio stations, micro and community, whatever you want to call them, to rebroadcast it locally in their FM dial. and we did this in Seattle for the World Trade Organization meetings there. We had a wonderful broadcast for the debates, which didn't really get a lot of media coverage. I know that the New York Times spent maybe 2 or 3 trees transcribing the whole thing. But we ran an alternative broadcast from the streets, and there were so many people calling in to communicate with. You know, we had people who had been locked out of the debates, like Ralph Nader and the Social Workers Party guy, on the phone doing interviews, and people actually calling in and interacting with them, live reports from the streets, and that's happened over and over again. And the groups that I work with outside of the Independent Media Center always try to make sure that there's some kind of local distribution element. And I heard Earl talking earlier about, you know, sharing our material and getting it out there and finding distribution networks. And I hear a lot of talk about distribution, and I think we should be talking more about access. And that's when I wanted to share stories with you about access in these community media centers, because there's this phenomena with technology, and I was talking with someone about it earlier today. Technology has this weird trip on people's minds. Whenever they get a new piece of technology, you know, it's often bought with personal funds. There's this personal claim to it. There's this person, and there's even like little passwords that you can put in to like freeze up the screen and freeze up the computer. There's been situations where I've been at media convergences, and it's great that people bring in this personal equipment. Every webcasting station that we set up, every transmitter that we set up at these convergences has been personal stuff donated. But people donate differently. Yeah, you can use it, but I'm going to be over you 24/7 watching you, you know? And that's the kind of equipment that you don't want, you know? And if you do get that kind of stuff, you want to pull those people aside and talk with them about community media and access and how access specifically defines us differently than the mainstream media. Yep. And how those passwords need to be thrown out, and how this equipment needs to be turned over. And one other thing that I think needs to happen more often is not only providing access, but providing people the skills. And so if you have knowledge to produce media, then it is your duty to also be a teacher. And one thing that didn't happen enough at this conference that could have happened more was more teaching. And I know that with these panels, people have learned a lot, but I mean skills, actual hard-on skills. We had a Geeks Night Out with the transmitter workshop over there, but it was a very small select group of guys who had wandered over. You know, not the ages didn't even vary very much either, but it would have been great to do it in this big top, you know, and have, you know, several transmitters lining up and down here and everybody getting a chance to solder. I've done workshops like this, and it's great. I've taken transmitters into schools and talked with kids about transistors and vibrating airwaves and just like the eardrum and your ear and things like that. And it's great, the response. It's great, the response. And you share the skills, and even if they don't apply them later, at least you've broken down that barrier between, you know, mainstream media and them as acting as if, you know, they have some grand mission in life that's been given to them by God simply because they're using something that we are all supposed to own, right? The public airwaves, the public television networks, and, you know, all of these issues. And so, yeah, access and teaching, and I think those should be the two core elements. If you're ever starting anything, or if you have something going, you know, if you have existing community radio stations, I heard something about old Crouchers, something, you know?
Curmudgeons.
Curmudgeons, yes. So old curmudgeons, you know, if you have something like that, then, you know, have an open house. Have an open house once a month and have the station open at accessible hours for the community to come in. And we've done a few of those, and it's been really fabulous, the people that come in for open house and actually give them a chance to be on the mic. Not only open house, but open mic as well.
Thank you.
Let me just say that we have somewhere between 5 and 10 more minutes. The plenary is going to be held here, and I know there's a lot of stuff on that, so let's just be mindful of that. Kathy?
I'll say this as quickly as possible. Believe it or not, we also own our mainstream public television stations, right? I mean, that's hard to believe. And I just want to let you all know about an organization you might not be aware of, CIPB, Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting. You might know of Jerry Starr. He's an amazing guy. And they will send you a great video to explain their organization and to tell you how you can organize in your community to pressure your own public television station to play all these great documentaries that are out there that are not being played. And I think we need a national effort to pressure our public television stations to play that video. So check it out on the web, cipb.org. And, you know, we really have to start looking not only around at what we can have and keep looking down to bringing it up from the grassroots, but look up to those mainstream wasted things like public television and NPR-type radio stations and try to take them back, too. Thanks.
Yeah. Actually, one of the tools you can have is... There was in the one of the things we got passed in 1979 is the Public Television Broadcasting Act, which requires that all board meetings and committee meetings, except for personnel, which includes budget, they are open to the public. And if your public television station or public radio station is not allowing you in, you can actually sue them and get in, because that is one of the requirements. That they have open meetings. So I was hoping that sort of after the Pacifica victory that we would move right on to NPR and then PBS, and I think that's really necessary to do.
And even CBS.
And then ABC and NBC. They're using public airwaves, you know.
Does anybody else have comments? Questions?
I just have some naive questions. I don't understand. What?
No, sorry.
Thank you. I know that the internet, you have to apply for a domain or you have to apply for a space or whatever it is. I mean, you said in the ITU regulates the television signals and someone, FCC, regulates the broadcast spectrum. What does it mean to be off the grid? I'd like to know, what does it mean legally and physically to be off the grid? And how do these organizations get the control in the first place? I don't understand. If you could tell me that in 25 words or less, I'd appreciate it. And physically, I'd like to know how vulnerable we are to being blocked if we operate off the grid. You know, have the central lines cut or whatever, blocked by whatever it is, means they use.
How these organizations get started for the last 30 years, people have been organizing around access to public access, and it's a history that has a long history, but it really means the people in the local communities have to get organized. It's not going to happen from the benefit of the cable corporation. They're not going to give you public access. You have to demand it. And it's the quid pro quo that the city is giving the cable company their rights of way so that they have to have a payback. So that's what you have to convince your city that they need a payback, and then that's how you get public access. In terms of getting off the grid, I think that image is really to get off the electric grid so that you have solar and other, like actually in Africa they have these wind-up radios so that you don't depend upon electricity. Actually, one of my favorite videos is from Dominican Republic, and they have a group there called TV Machepa, which makes tapes in the streets and then goes around, and it's similar to this van, only not as fancy. It's basically like a broken down old truck that has a TV set and runs off the battery. But they run their TV, and one of my favorite scenes is this guy is talking, and he's he's being taped on a home camcorder, right? And the electricity goes off, and so there's no lights, but he keeps talking. And he's talking about how terrible the situation is in Dominican Republic, and he just keeps talking. And then finally the lights sort of flicker and come back on again. And then he takes this tape out and goes shows it on the street. And to me, that's sort of the ultimate in kind of community broadcasting, because he's in the dark just like the audience is, you know. So, you can do what, there's different ways of getting off the grid. You don't have to be
broadcasting on a cable or through the air, you can actually take tapes. A lot of countries, like Brazil, has an incredible networks, TV Machambomba. Around Rio, they have two vans that go out every single night of the week and show video, and actually they never go out without a camera. They never just show video, because they always feel if the camera's broken, they don't go out. They always feel that that there has to be a live component. So the night I went there, and there were 300 people there, they ended up, they were talking about AIDS, and they were the last tape was about how women can convince their boyfriends to wear condoms or whatever. And I looked over, and all of a sudden I realized that the last interview was live. And they had already lined up somebody. So then they went on for 2 hours talking about that with the local people there. So it's an incredible use of real interactive TV. So I think that's one of the things. I think that van that was just here, they go out to parking lots and stuff and show stuff about animal rights. And I think that's the kind of thing you don't have to be on the grid to do.
Well, no. That's what I'm interested in, because I think it's dangerous.
Come to the mic if you...
Well, that's what I'm interested in, exactly. It's dangerous for us to be dependent on just electronic connection.
You know? By any means necessary.
Yeah, right.
Right. And most of the world is off the grid, whether they want to be or not. So, I mean, one of the things that we need to remember when we're talking about things like digital divide is that most people on the planet have never touched a telephone, okay? So they are nowhere near the grid. Come on up to the mic. We can keep going as long as you want to keep going, and the plenary people don't show up, but we should take a few minutes break, so let's...
I got here a little bit late, so I didn't really hear the topic title, but I do hear you're discussing the digital divide, and the fact that a lot of people don't have access to it, especially in a lot of the urban areas. Most people don't have computers. Most people don't have access to the internet. A lot of people are so busy trying to stay alive that they're stuck in the grind of the rat race. So they don't have most people distracted. So one of the things that I thought would be helpful, especially in the urban areas, is to possibly go into those low-income areas yourselves with a small group, a small entourage, and talk to the people personally up close, and then even maybe invite some of them down and try to even employ, if at all possible, some of these people from these low-income neighborhoods like myself, you know what I mean, employ them or train them, you know, and then I think that would probably widen your audience more, because then, you know, everybody else in the neighborhood, oh, you work there, because everybody asked me, yo, you go down there? So I got my whole neighborhood interested in WBAI. Because everybody sees what I'm doing, so they're interested and they ask me questions about what's going on. So now I got the whole neighborhood listening to it just by me being there and talking to them.
One of the things, I'm going to turn this over to you. Regarding telephones, one of the things I want to say that's happening a lot is that public telephones are being pulled out of neighborhoods everywhere because they're not making money anymore. Too many people have cell phones. And so... again, in neighborhoods where people are least likely to have private phones, they're also going away. So communications technology is contracting there. It's not expanding. Errol?
Yeah, and also I just wanted to add that as it seems the media flourish, we talk less and less to one another, and we know less and less about what's going on in and around our own communities. So, you know, that is something to consider. But, Rick, one of the things that I noticed a few years that was going on was that folks were able to make and communicate either rap tapes, CDs, and other information. And that is a form of community media. Could you talk a little bit about how that works and, you know, where that is in terms of its development that we're not seeing on our radar screen?
Well, just like, the gentleman Pete Seeger yesterday, we see how he, you know, the stuff that he sings, you know, it's very humorous and people remember that. because it's so humorous that you don't, you know, you remember parts that I've never heard of the man, but I heard what he said about the driveway and the parkway and all these other things, you know, and I will never forget that. So I think Errol has a very good point, because you got a lot of rap artists now like Nas who's doing conscious hip hop. No longer is it about the bling bling and the rings and the cars and all of that. A lot of them are starting to wake up. They're becoming older. They're getting more mature. I'm in the studio with Dred Scott myself. I have written a few things, which you'll probably hear over the radio. He's going to put it on after we finish in the studio, edited it, and doing everything to it. But I think Merrill Maitland has a very good point. Especially in those neighborhoods where, you know, people cannot afford computers and get on the internet, just by the music and what the lyrics and some of the music that's played. You know, like a lot of my homies, they listen to hip-hop. But if you play, like, a conscious hip-hop record, they're still going to listen to it. But at the same time, they're going to learn something from it. And it might pique their curiosity.
Actually, there's a group that is putting together a tour called Hip-Hop Against Infinite War. So watch for it in your city. And the idea is to... A lot of these Army and Marine ads have been trying to use hip-hop to kind of get people to join up, and so they're really doing this consciously to actually say, hey, there's some hip-hop artists that don't want to do anything for the Army. They don't want to get any more kids in the Army. We want to do something against war and against the kind of militarism that's sweeping this country.
Exactly.
And so they're doing a big hit. The War Resisters League is also involved in this, and but it sounds like I think Michael Franti too, and Mos Def.
Yeah. Yes, Mos Def, yeah. Kweli, Tali. And I think you're absolutely right. If you got the military and you got commercial, you know, using hip hop, you look at all the commercial now, they're using hip hop. I think we need to counter that with some conscious hip hop.
The Public Enemy, I think, you know, Chuck D, those guys, they developed literally, they used to go around in Hempstead with bicycles and video cameras and a bullhorn and make media. And now they have opened the center where they go and they challenge these politicians. And it is, the encounter is not pleasant from the point of view of the public official who has been challenged. But they put it on, television out in Hempstead. In my own house, you know, I've discovered samples of Malcolm X, that I've discovered that my CD and the computer and my equipment has been used to turn out a factory of these sounds and stuff that gets mixed and sampled and traded around. So it is news that is going on. You know, I thought I had a box of 90 cassettes the other day, and I looked in there and there were only like 10 left. So I just gave it to him. My microphones, they get confiscated, because, you know, the kids, they mix, they create and they innovate and they share. And when we talk about the technology not being there, they are creating studios using PCs, even in the hood. And as a matter of fact, that's where I got XP from, one of these guys, you know, about 6 months ago. But so they do understand how to use the technology, young people, and they do need to, and they do know how to put it together. I think one of the ways we're not seeing it and we're failing them is that we are not creating spaces in our stations for these folks to come in and innovate. As Dee Dee says, this web radio business is incredible. I discovered web radio when my son knew everything there was to know about getting on the internet, because he was broadcasting to two or three people. You know, but they're doing it, and I think we need to learn, and we need to bring them in, and give them a little space, a little time. Doesn't have to be prime time, but before you know it, it will happen.
But we have to fight to get the computers in the schools and stuff so kids can learn this stuff. Actually, I had an incident happen in Woodstock, New York, a couple of miles from here. Woodstock had last year had a vote about, they wanted to appropriate a tiny piddling bit amount, like $100,000, to buy computers for the school, and they voted it down because it's one of the few times people can actually vote against taxes is when they had the school taxes. But the police, the damn police. When I first came to Woodstock, there were two police. We now have 17 police in that town because they can get federal grants from the crime bill, from Clinton's crime bill, and they can get any kind of computer equipment they have. Every single, they have 13 police cars. When I first moved to Woodstock 25 years ago, they had one police car. And every single police car has a big fancy computer. They get new ones every other year. They have an office full of computers. And the police and the military in this country get whatever equipment they have, but the schools suffer.
What do they do with the old computers?
They have to turn them back to the state.
And if you steal them, they arrest you. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. There's
and also one of the things, too, in schools where there are computers, a lot of times they are put in restriction on what you can do with them. And you can't learn in an environment where there are restrictions because these... You know, these people, they're doing things with machines that were unimaginable, but they have the imagination and the know-how to do it. And it works. You know, my son at 4 years old discovered that you could edit sound on the computer and play around with it. So it happens the computer only had 20 gig and the, you know, not 20 gig, 20 megs, and he, you know, would fill it up so his mother couldn't do the work. But he would also know how to erase it. But turn them loose, and they will create.
Yeah. We have one last question, and I think we should probably stop so we can all take a break because I know the plenary is pretty jam-packed. Okay. Please go ahead.
All right.
Introduce yourself and take that microphone. Okay. There we go.
All right. Hi, my name is Christina, and actually I'm coming from Hudson, New York. And actually, I heard the Didi speak like in the winter up in Albany, and I'm just got the nerve to talk because this guy said something because I was too shy to say anything before. But after,
get a little closer to the mic?
Yeah, I'm bad at this with mics. I hate them. Anyway, and after I talked to Didi, somebody from WRPI Troy asked me because I was doing a lot of community activism in Hudson, which is about 30 miles south of Albany. And I was doing a lot of peace activism, community activism, and they asked me if I could do a program on the radio about what was happening in Columbia County in the southern listening area of WRPI. So I said I'd do it. It scared the hell out of me, and I did it, and I was really nervous, and I still have no radio voice, and I did it for the whole summer. And what I did, basically, and the reason why I'm saying something to you is because what I did is I went into the community. It was a community center. The first thing I did is there was a guy with a four-track, and he was making all kinds of great music. So we got that on the tape recorder, right? Put that on the radio. People in the community got to hear themselves, kids, right? It was really great, you know. And then the other thing is I started going to, like, different meetings in the community. Like, I went to the farmer's market and interviewed a whole bunch of people. I went out of my own pocket. I work as a waitress, and I went out and I bought a digital recorder because this guy talked me into buying it, and then he said we could edit this stuff, and then the guy stopped talking to me, and so I had no way of editing it. And I can't even give you an email address because I don't have a computer, I don't have email, I hardly have an electrical outlet in my apartment, okay? But the thing is, Hudson's a very poor community, but it's amazing that I've lived there in that community for so long that it's really... I know everybody there. So everybody I knew, I would go to the farmer's market. I grabbed this girl. She was a farmer. The next week, she co-hosted the show with me. And then I went and then interviewed even a guy who wrote a book, Native New Yorkers, Evan Pritchard, and put him on the show. And he and his son did the music and everything. So I think what I'm saying is that there are even existing stations that you could take advantage of. And somebody like me who doesn't know anything about radio would invite people, and I have my book with me that can tell you about all the shows that I've done. You know, it's 13 shows, did things with the Quakers, went to the Green Party picnic, you know, interviewed them and then brought them on the radio, had all these people come in and co-host, and including music and kids, and Nas is really excellent, Poison, you know, and the things have become, exactly.
What's right. The frequency, the radio station?
91.5 FM. And the thing is here's the deal. You know, you hear Amy Goodman every morning. I've listened to them for years. Pacifica, you know, there's really good rap. The rap shows are excellent on the weekend. But you don't, but you know what you don't hear? I have to say this with a little pride. You don't hear people with a voice like mine, because people say, I've never heard anybody, like, when you go, or you say wonderful too many times, or something stupid like that. They love it. They call me up, man, and they say,
yeah. Hey.
Okay, so, and it's good, and then you can bring in the Rape Crisis Center, all your community groups, and the other last thing I wanted to say is what I read on every show is two introductions. One is that, yes, the people have the power, but why don't they know it? And what I try to do is bring that voice out there to say that, you know, that there are superheroes, you know, that the culture always feeds to, and there's movie stars, and I'm saying that, and I don't mean in a corny way, but there are people in the community every day who are the real heroes, because I even worked in an emergency room for many years as a nurse also, and I really believe that we are the heroes, but we don't know it, and we have to counter that by hearing our own voices, our own music, and I don't mean overly produced stuff. And
what's your name again?
Christina.
And I'm happy you came in the tent. I've been looking at you outside the tent.
I didn't even feel like I belonged here, but I came. Okay, thank you.
All right.
I think we have to stop, and I think the note we might stop on is to say there's no such thing as a radio voice. They're just all the voices.
That's right, and thank you very much for coming here today and sharing with us.
I have a few copies of the Milan Declaration on the right to communicate if anybody has...